Ray McGovern, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So you've had a long history working with the CIA, and I really want to get into the CIA. I want to start there. You know, this is an organization that began 1947, and pretty quickly after that, within 5 years, we know of at least the first coup in Iran, the removing of the Iranian prime minister by the CIA. I'm just curious, with your long history of working there, did you know when you were there that these were the types of things the CIA was doing?
It's a tough question. When I was in graduate school, getting my master's degree in Russian studies, when I was teaching Russian, I learned about why the Central Intelligence Agency was set up. There was a book by Harry Ransom, I believe his name was, Central Intelligence and National Security. And it depicted the reasons why President Truman set up this one agency to report directly to him, right? Not through the Pentagon, who always pictured the Russians as being 10 feet tall, not through the State Department, which was always defending its own policies. Somebody directly reporting to him without fear or favor, someone who he and the National Security Council controlled our careers. So give it to me straight. As Truman would say, give it to me untreated intelligence. Now, it was a very good idea. I mean, he was around under FDR. He knew how the Army and the State Department, everybody else, were maneuvering against one another. He wanted to consolidate and make it a central place. That sounded great to me, okay? Then I learned that the Central Intelligence Agency is also not only overseeing all the other agencies, but is an analysis group to give the president this straight poop, as we would say, okay? Then what happened? Well, in 1946, 47, really courageous people came back from what was the Office of Strategic Services, the spies in World War II. I mean, these were really imaginative and courageous people, jumping in behind enemy lines, blowing up things, removing dictators and so forth, okay? So they came back into town and they said, thanks for all the applause. And the applause, as I say, was very well deserved. But the question was, now, should we hang around here? I mean, is there work for us? I mean, like, or should we go back to our universities, our corporations, all our firms? The answer was, oh, no, stay here, we need you. Why? Because the Russians are doing all kinds of stuff that you guys can do. We need you to do that to match the Russians, okay? So they hung around. Then the question became, where do we put these guys? I mean, like, you can't have an agency for regime change. Oh, we didn't have that nice, polite agency for overthrowing governments. Just didn't work. So George Kennan and other people who I used to respect very much said, I know what we do. We'll put them in with the analysis shop being created by President Truman. It's got to be a secret shop because they're going to use spies for substantive information. And these guys will have to be secret. We'll put them all in the same agency and it'll be one happy company. A structural fault from the very beginning. Now, going to your question about whether I knew that the Iranian government was being toppled. Well, that was before I joined the agency, but I kind of knew because that was sort of like the last chapter in this book I mentioned that had this wonderful glorified view of what I could do as an analyst, tell it straight to the president without fear or favor, and be in charge of the rest of the intelligence agency as seconded by the director of Central Intelligence. So there were turnstiles. You know the old turnstiles you used to have in the subways? You're probably too young, Kim, but we used to have turnstiles. You used to put a dime in there. That's my, yeah. Now it's more, I understand. And there are no more turnstiles. But in 1963, and it's exactly April 8th is when I appeared in 1963 at the Central Intelligence Agency. in its spanking new building in Langley, Virginia, and I found that every floor in that seven-story building was divided by turnstiles. If you were an analyst, you couldn't go to the operations side of the house. We talked about side of the house. Well, it was literally that side of the house, okay? The operations people could not come to the analysts. That's how hermetically sealed we were off one from the other. Now, that's good in a sense, because then the operations people can't detain the intelligence. But it's not really good, because the intelligence people can't tell the operations people, this is a really stupid idea. I mean, blowing up a pipeline under the Baltic Sea, I mean, that's going to come back on hardship. I mean, that's really stupid. And I served under 9 directors of Central Intelligence. There was only one, and I worked directly for him, Bill Colby, who gave analysts a crack at these cockamamie operations that they would do because they had the money to do it, and it was fun to do it, and they could blow up stuff, and, you know, okay. So Colby used to say, McGovern, here's what this group is trying to do to overthrow the young lieutenant colonels in Portugal and bring back the Salazar fascist regime, okay? That's what they're trying to do. Now, we think that Kissinger is behind this, but he hasn't told us about it. So I want you to go down and talk to Kissinger and tell him, hey, we're onto this. This is really stupid. I did, okay? Now, these were superannuated generals anyhow in the Azores, right? But they never got to first base. But that's the kind of thing that a bright sort of Renaissance man like Bill Colby was, a lawyer and a decent fellow. There are things that weren't so good about him, like the Phoenix program. But at least he had the good sense at the top of this big structure, the superstructure over all agencies, and then the structure of the CIA, to let us have a crack at these crazy things. So what do I say now? I say that I was able, as a Russian analyst, I speak fluent Russian, I used to teach it, I was in Russia for a while, we were able to tell it the way we saw it. That was really invigorating. This stuff going right to the president, right? Later, I got to brief one-on-one the president's daily brief. But the notion that we could have direct access without being flavored or tainted by other agency, that was really, so it was a big responsibility, and we have to be completely honest about it, which I was. Then Bill Casey came in under Reagan. Bobby Gates, who I'm ashamed to admit worked for me at one point early in my career, they said the Russians will never, ever give up quietly. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union will never leave without violence. Well, that was completely cockamamie. I was able to personally tell Secretary Shultz and others that, no, Gorbachev is the real deal. Deal with him. And we know the rest of that story. So what I'm saying is, beginning in 81, when Casey came in, it began to be really tainted, just as Truman didn't want it to be tainted, by political considerations, by people who had this animus against Russia, who had people who thought they were exceptional, and, you know, they still believe they're exceptional. And that was the damage that was done. The Soviet Union imploded. Guess what? The official people in the CIA were surprised, not those of us who knew that Gorbachev was the real deal. Maybe I'll stop talking at this point.
Well, you mentioned, okay, so you're saying that in 1981, that is when things changed, that the CIA became this other sort of entity. But we know that there was a lot of, I would say, bad stuff that was going on prior to that point. From the inception of the CIA in 1947, like I mentioned, really quickly after that, there was this coup in Iran, you know, taking out the prime minister there. We've seen this, you know, these subsequently, then there was, of course, the assassination in South Vietnam, or, you know, there were the attempts of overthrowing coups everywhere, right? So there's these attempts, sometimes successful, sometimes unsuccessful. JFK, I mean, this is one that now we're getting so many more of the papers. There's still 1% of the documents we can't see, which means those are the damning documents if they're not releasing that one amount, the 3,000 pages that are left of the JFK assassination. Why won't they release that? That was in 1963. So this, it looks like the entity was sinister from the get-go, that it had intentions of, from the beginning, things that are very antithetical to what we Americans claim is the, you know, we're always saying we're fighting for democracy. We're all about democracy. Yet we're going around the world, assassinating leaders, staging coups, overthrows, which is completely antithetical to democracy entirely. Even if the person is a dictator in another country, you know, there's something to be said for people doing that on their own rather than having some outside government meddle, right? I don't know. I mean, but that's what you would know. I mean, you spent all of those years in the CIA and you were there during those times. I mean, you were there starting in 1963 all the way until the 90s. So there's a lot there that happened before 1981 with the CIA.
Yeah, Kim, I should have been clearer. I was talking, I thought I had set up the discussion to indicate that there are two CIAs. Okay.
Okay.
The one I worked in. The one that analyzed Soviet foreign policy. I was chief of the Soviet policy branch. The kind of contribution we made, and I'll just mention this one. 1970, 71, people decided that maybe it would be good to limit strategic nuclear weapons. That's a good idea, you know? Kissinger or Nixon came to us and said, you think the Russians are serious about this? We said, yeah. And they said, why? Two reasons, okay? One, they don't want to get into an arms race, which would blow their whole economy. Number two, they're really afraid that China will steal March and get cozy relationships with you all. They feel themselves in competition with China for a good relationship with U.S. So they went ahead. We saw flexibility in those negotiations. I had three people in my branch involved in the SALT talks. One was with the delegation, whether it was in Helsinki or Vienna. One was down in the bowels of the CIA working with the military experts. And one was preparing the substantive briefs for Director Helms and the muckety-mucks in Washington. Okay. Now, what happened? Kissinger comes to us and says, okay, looks like we got a deal. You were right. They're interested, but should we go ahead? Are they going to cheat? That's our job, right? Trust but verify. So we said, don't know if they're going to cheat. Well, if they cheat, how soon can you tell us? Went back to the people around the satellites and all the other collection mechanisms, and they said, about a week, 10 days. A week to 10 days, Dr. Kissinger. All right. That's good enough. We'll trust if you can verify. Did the Soviets cheat? Yeah, they cheated. They built up another great big ABM radar system and we called them on it. They took it down. Okay. So what I'm saying is that the substantive people had an incredibly important role to play and we played it. Now in 81, the first thing Casey did was say, now, okay, you substantive people, I want you to write a memo that says that the Russians are behind all terrorism in the world. My colleagues, to their credit, says, but they're not, Mr. Casey. You know what he did? He set up a separate little analysis group that could give him the answer that he wanted. That's when things became tainted on the substantive side. Now, let me go back to the operational side. These guys, they came home from the war. Okay. Now, it was a fledgling organization in 1953. And what did those Iranians do? Well, Mossadegh, the first independently and freely elected leader of Iran in about three millennia. Okay. So he says, you know, the British are getting all the spoils here from the oil underneath the sands of Iran. I think we should get more of a share for the Iranian people. He said, maybe we should nationalize them. Now, the British came to the fledgling CIA and said, one of them was Kermit Roosevelt from the Roosevelt family. He said, now, from the CIA side, now, this is what you do when some upstart starts to think that the oil underneath their soil belongs to them, instead of British Petroleum or its forerunner. So they did the coup. That was 1953. 1954, Arbenz in Guatemala is a sort of a progressive, call them leftist at the time. Well, the propaganda people on the other side of the house call them a communist. United Fruit was not interested in Arbenz nationalizing their plantations, their pineapple farms and so forth. And so there was a coup there. Okay. The worst one in that I was directly actually there for, that is at CIA headquarters, was the one against Allende in Chile on September 11th of all things, 1973. Okay. That was the worst. Now, why do I say it's the worst? Because he was progressive. He was duly elected and they didn't want him to set an example that a socialist could become head of a country. Now, what was the real concern? Kissinger's real concern was Italy. Okay? The same with Portugal, I mentioned before. If you let socialists, they're almost communists, right? You let them lead a country or have a significant role in the leadership of that country, what's going to happen in Italy? Before you know it, the Italian Communist Party is going to be part of the government. That's the whole, that's the big prize. We have to prevent that. So I watched all this stuff and, you know, we didn't know diddly about, you know, what was happening. We would read the New York Times the day after and find out, oh, Allende's, he's been removed. He's committed suicide, they say. So there's this disconnect between operations and substantive intelligence. And I have to say that 81 is sort of the divide. Because the people that Gates and Casey promoted into leadership positions of the analysis of the CIA were all people who would say, yes, sir, we see communists. We see three communists under the rocks here in Nicaragua. And of course, the Russians are responsible for all manner of terrorism in the world. Sure they are. And so it became corrupted then. Now it's completely corrupt. Now the turnstiles are down. Now the analysts are sitting with the operators. And when the operators say, oh, we got all this money. And we found out that when Jake Sullivan asked if we could blow up the pipeline, we can do that now. The director of Central Intelligence, the CIA director now, William Burns, doesn't have the guts to stand up to the operations people who have all this money and who can do what Burns's supervisor, Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, want them to do. And so Burns said, oh, okay, President said blow it up, blow it up. Now, did he ask the analysts for their input? Cy Hirsch says, well, yeah, he did a little bit. And the analysts say, this is crazy, this is awful. It went ahead anyway. This is the way it always happens. The analysts, well, we did. Under Colby, we were able to put the kibosh on some really stupid things that never would have worked. But else, other times, not so much. And now I despair of any. There's no leadership at the top of the CIA. We thought Bill Burns might be kind of an adult in the room. He certainly knows a lot about foreign affairs. But in effect, he's a bureaucrat. He'll do whatever the policy is. And if the policy is to blow up some pipelines, he'll tell us, do it. The president wants to do it. And then, you know, less of all, this is kind of brings it back to the substantive things. You know, when we talk about Ukraine and NATO wanting to incorporate Ukraine, this was a real big deal for Russia. They didn't want that to happen for obvious reasons, if you look at the map. So when this became a real current subject, when people started talking about not only Ukraine, but Georgia, the country of Georgia, being incorporated in NATO, the head of the foreign ministry in Russia, his name then and now is Sergei Lavrov. He called our ambassador in. The date was February 1, 2008. Our ambassador happened to be a fellow named Bill Burns, now CIA director. He says, Mr. Burns, do you know what Nyet means? Bird said, well, yeah, you know, he said, well, Nyet means Nyet. If you insist on incorporating Ukraine into NATO, there will be civil war in Ukraine, and we Russians will have to figure out whether we need to intervene or not. That's in the cable.
Okay. Wow.
To his credit, Burns says, you know, Russia has these strategic concerns, and, you know, they're actually, they're entitled to, they're entitled to have these strategic. Now, that was a gutsy thing because Cheney, Bush, and Condoleezza Rice, his nominal boss, they didn't want to hear that, that Russia has legitimate concerns. So that was Bill Burns in 2008. Okay, he writes the cable, played it straight. The title of the cable is Nyet means Nyet, Russia's red line on accession to NATO by Ukraine and Georgia. Okay, now how do we know that? WikiLeaks. Thank God for WikiLeaks. Is the cable from Embassy Moscow authentic? If I've seen one cable from Embassy Moscow, I've seen probably about 5,000 or 6,000. Yes, it's authentic. No one has called it inauthentic. The rest of the story, of course, is that 2 months later, Cheney and Bush persuade our allies to say in the NATO summit document, Bucharest, April 3rd, 2008, 2 months later, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. So that was 2008. You know what happened in 2014 when we overthrew the duly constituted government of Ukraine in Kiev. Now, substantive analysts didn't have anything to do with that, okay? We would have said, you know, what's going to happen now? How's Russia going to react to that? Well, the people running all this policy, Victoria Nuland and now Bill Burns, say, well, who gives a damn about Russia's fear? We are exceptional. We can do what we want. If we want to put missile bases right up against the Russian border in Romania and in Poland, which already are there, we're going to do it. And, you know, we're not going to pay heed to what Bill Burns alluded to very early on in 2008, that Russia has its own legitimate security concerns about the region. So let's do the dichotomy, these crazy policies and their implementation to include blowing up pipelines. That's all done on the operational side of the house. And worse still, the analysts are now so kind of mixed in with the operators, they find themselves targeting drones. They find themselves excluded still from actually commenting on cockamamie plans like blowing up pipelines. So it's worse than it ever was. And, you know, there's a real question in my mind as to whether the CIA, to the degree it has, is kind of to what it is now, it probably should be better to give the operations people over to the Pentagon or something, set up a separate think tank that is beyond political considerations like we used to be, and just kind of dissolve the rest of it, give the fancy satellite photography and other imagery to some other agency. It has long since passed its best use. And I, you know, really hard to say that after 27 years and high medallion awards and so forth. But it was good then. It's not really good now. And, you know, with respect to Ukraine, Bill Burns and his nominal boss, April Haynes, the director of national intelligence, are telling the Biden people, I don't know if Joe Biden's really with it, but telling Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken and Victoria Nuland that there's a chance that Ukraine can win in Ukraine. That's crazy. Not even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff can agree to that. And there's trouble ahead, because if they don't recognize that Ukraine can't win and that Russia, because this is an existential threat to Russia, has to win, we're in trouble deep, because escalation next step could eventually lead to the use of nuclear weapons.
Yeah. So then, I mean, what you're describing with the CIA is a lot of bureaucracy almost. You've got this, you mentioned these analysts that are kind of doing this the actual intelligence work, but not really being listened to. Almost like the analysts are just there to run cover for the operation so that the operation side can say, well, we asked the analysts and, you know, there was disagreement. Some said this, some said that. So we chose this. It's just the path we chose because these different, you know, the analysts are saying different things. So it's almost a way to, because ultimately if something goes really awry, somebody's got to answer for it. So it's good if the ops guys, I guess, can say, well, the analysts said that this was, how to do it. So it sounds like.
Well, let me just interrupt for a second. Nobody's ever held accountable. Ops guys. So that's really important.
I guess that's true. Right, right. Okay. So that's not even a thing. But then who's in charge of these ops guys? Who's actually directing them? Because it sounds to me what you're describing is a bunch of different people could possibly tap into this clandestine military, black ops group, the CIA essentially, to go and do whatever it is they want. And it's almost like anyone that's at a certain level in the U.S. government can tap in and say, I got an operation for you. So I want you guys to go and do this.
Well, depending on how important he is, I mean, take the pipeline blow up. We know.
So who are the people? I mean, like what level? I mean, obviously the president could maybe say, I want you to do something. Who else could say, I want you to do something? And they actually have to do it without running it up the chain all the way to the president.
Jacob Sullivan.
Okay.
And that's the way it was originally set up. Do you recall when I said that we would answer directly to the president and to the National Security Advisor? That's the guy who the head of intelligence really has the first entree to the president. So, yeah, as far as Biden is concerned, I am really, really worried that he is out of it. I cannot come to any other conclusion. It doesn't matter what I worry about or what Putin and Xi worry about. That counts. That matters. And I can't see that they come to any other conclusion. So who are these other guys? Well, as Cy Hirsch says, Jacob Sullivan. Now, he was the one that commissioned this study to see, can we blow them up? And this was before the invasion, well before the invasion, okay? And they came back after a month or so, said, yeah, we could blow it up. We got the Navy, the Norwegians are going to help, but yeah, we can do it. But we have to be very secret, very secret. And then Biden, on the 7th of February last year, blows the operation. He says in response to a reporter, he says, if the Russians invade Ukraine, there's not going to be any more Nord Stream. Okay. And she says, well, how are you going to do that? You're not in charge. He said, I promise you, we can do it. Now, that was quite a scene. Next to Biden at the next podium was the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. Okay. The Reuters woman, the gutsy reporter, she turns to Scholz and she says, Herr Kanzler, was halten Sie davon? What do you think, Mr. Chancellor? What do you think about that? And he goes, we do everything together. There's nothing of importance that we do that we don't do together. Okay, that's February 7th. That's after Biden knows that he can get these guys to blow up that pipeline. Did he tell Scholz on February 7th? Or did he not? Was Scholz completely überrascht, surprised in September when it was blown? That's the question the German people are asking Scholz now. What did you know? And when did you know it? Did you do this together or not? Either way, it speaks very ill of Scholz. Now, let me just go back one other thing, because I remember you mentioned how the analysts and the operators escape blame or blame one another. They're so corrupted now. Remember I said 81 is when I call them the malleable managers that Gates, who is head of analysis, put in place. So that's 81. Come down to 91, when little Bush Jr. comes in. Okay, now the CIA is run by a bunch of malleable managers, Cheney and Bush say we want to make a war on Iraq and we need to have the intelligence to justify it. And then, I mean, this is very hard to say. I mean, this is as bad as it gets. The analysts, well, don't take my word for it. Senator Jay Rockefeller, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, after a five-year study, issued a bipartisan report which said, and I quote, "The evidence adduced to justify the attack on Iraq was uncorroborated, contradicted, or even non-existent," period, end quote. What does non-existent intelligence look like? It looks like made-up stuff. So our former colleagues made up this stuff to justify what we, at the time, retired guys in veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, warned Bush three times with what we said in our first memo after Powell's speech. Same day, we said, Mr. Bush, or President Bush, we strongly advise that you widen the circle of your advisors beyond those who are clearly bent on a war for which we see no compelling reason and from which we believe the unintended consequences are likely to be catastrophic. That's February 5th, 2003. And we don't take any joy at having been right. This is just awful, okay? So what I'm saying here is that why I said 81 and then I say 2001, you had people in charge of the analysis part that were just as corrupt, just as willing to please, just as, yes, sir, we could do this to include falsifying intelligence as the operators who, you know, have no compunction. I mean, you know, the truth doesn't mean as much on the operational side for obvious reasons. In war, and we're always at war, right? Truth is the first casualty, as everyone knows.
So let's talk about this, the aggression, this constant aggression towards Russia. You were an expert in Russia at the CIA, spending a lot of time analyzing them, I would imagine, maybe even spying on them, I don't know. But where is this obsession coming from? Are they out to get us? Because that's really what it's sort of, I mean, at the root cause, the root of it all, if we're going to be this, if we're going to aggravate Russia, develop NATO to counter the Soviets, to stop the Russians from rebuilding the USSR, which is sort of the current narrative is, well, if they take Ukraine, then they're going to just keep spreading and spreading and spreading. They want to go back to the old USSR. Where is this coming from? Is there information out there where the Russians are talking to each other saying, let's get them. We've got to go after the West. We've got to go after the United States. And so we have every reason to be worried and to actually continue to push at Russia.
No. Simple answer is no. There's not one scintilla of evidence that Putin or his advisors ever got it into their head to reestablish the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union came apart in 1991, actually. What happened then? Wall Street and a group called the Harvard Boys went into Moscow and advised Boris Yeltsin, a drunk from the word go, as to how to plunder the Russian economy, how to privatize things. That's when the oligarchs, not only in Russia, but in the West, in Germany, in Ukraine, came to the fore and just plundered the Russian economy. Here's one statistic from the World Bank. Between 1991 and 1995, the mortality rate, or what's the word, the age at which Russian men died went from 63 in 1991 to 57 in 1995. Think about that. People were dying. People were malnourished. People were lying in the street. And Yeltsin was giving the economy away to these very smart Wall Street guys who who were sent over there to help them figure out how to de-Sovietize their economy. In 1996, Yeltsin was up for re-election. It looked very clear he was going to lose. Summoned the Wall Street Boys, all kinds of advisors. Hey, bring in the World Bank and the IMF. We'll rescue him. And they did. Time magazine has this wonderful picture of this drunken Yeltsin with an American flag and the advisors under here right after the election that he won, when it was a real come behind thing that the U.S. was responsible for. Now, what's the point here? Putin was around then, right? He watched all this happen. It's an accident of history. There are lots of theories. I still don't know exactly why Yeltsin picked Putin to succeed him. Maybe he had maybe he was knocked off his horse on the way to Damascus. Maybe just as he's going to die, he says, maybe I'll do one thing right for Russia. Here's a strong leader. Putin, you're the guy. So that's 1990. Now, what did he do? He reached out to the West. He said, we'd like to join NATO. There was talk of that before with Yeltsin. How about it? Not interested. Actually, NATO needs an enemy. And it's you guys. It's Russia. Okay, so that wouldn't work. Putin learned a tough lesson. He reached out to the West, got no real acceptance. You see, not to be sarcastic about this, but the West, NATO in particular, needs an enemy, for God's sake. I mean, they need a credible enemy. And Russia is elected. Who profits from this? Well, you all know the military-industrial complex does. And without an enemy, it doesn't work. So what happened was that Putin kept trying. He kept referring. And people noticed this, especially me. Our partners in the West, our partners, they kept calling. Now there are former partners in the West. What happened? Well, lots of things happened. As I mentioned before, 2008, we tried to incorporate, or we planned to. It was official NATO policy to incorporate Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. Now, there was a curious thing that happened about, 5 years later. We're talking 2013. Now, believe it or not, this was the apogee. This was the peak of good relations with Russia and the United States. What happened? Well, there was a false flag attack, chemical attack in Syria outside of Damascus, blamed on Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad, okay. Now, Bashar al-Assad's forces were winning, okay? There was no good reason for them to use sarin gas, but they were accused of doing that 25 times by Secretary of State John Kerry a week after it happened. Bashar al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad. Now, that was a red line set a year before by Hillary Clinton and her folks. Once the use of chemical weapons happened in Syria, then we would have to invade. Then all bets would be off. Even Obama was prompted to say, I would have to change my calculus. We might have to invade, or might have to strike out after Syria. So Obama was under incredible pressure. Okay. This was right at the end of August 2013. He said, I think we ought to go to Congress for permission. My God, go to Congress? Well, yeah, that's what the Constitution says. The neocons didn't like that at all. Okay. Especially Kerry. What happens? By circumstance or providence, if you will, Obama is due to appear in St. Petersburg for an economic summit of some sort. He's met by Putin. Putin takes him aside and says, I have a solution to your dilemma. I sense that you don't want to start another war. And so we have persuaded the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons, such as they have left, under UN supervision on a ship specifically outfitted for such destruction. Obama says, really? Kerry didn't tell me about that. Putin says, really? Listen to the Syrian foreign minister tomorrow. Syrian foreign minister announces it that next day. Obama's chestnuts are pulled out of the fire. He doesn't have to start another war. And he brags just 3 years later to his unofficial biographer, Jeffrey Goldberg, you know, I violated what Obama called the Washington playbook. All my advisors said, you have to attack Syria. I didn't want to do that. I stepped out. I'm very proud of that. That was a very good decision. Now, this was after all these Afghanistan, Libya from Hillary Clinton, all that stuff. So what did that mean? That meant that relations were really quite cordial. For how long? A month. On the 12th of September, 2013, the New York Times published an op-ed by Putin. What did he say? He said, I am really gratified at the increasing trust. Got that word? Increasing trust, not only between America and Russia, but between the President of the United States, Barack Obama, and myself. The only thing that I have to tell you I disagree with is the notion that some countries are exceptional. President Obama said that just 1 week ago, writes Putin. And I have to say that in my view, there are poor countries, big countries, there are little countries, there are people closer to democracy, others farther away. But when God looks down at all these countries, he considers them all equal. Whoa. Okay. Now, I happen to know, and there's proof of this, that Putin penned that last paragraph himself, okay? What happens? Oh, my God. We can't have increasing trust. What happens to our main enemy for NATO? So 6 months later, there's a coup orchestrated by the United States in the capital of Ukraine, Kiev. First thing the coup leaders say, is let's join NATO and let's bar Russian as an official language. The Crimeans don't like this. The people in the Donbass in the eastern part of Ukraine they don't accept the new coup regime, but there it is in place. What happens? Well, the Crimeans vote in a plebiscite to rejoin Russia. It's a long story as to how they got separated from Russia, but they're going to rejoin Russia. Okay. Now, if the neocons who were running this coup in Kiev, and it was the most blatant coup in history, it having been revealed by an intercepted conversation 2.5 weeks before the coup, okay, it was the most blatant coup in history. And what Putin did was come back from Sochi the day after the coup. It was the Winter Olympics were being finished in Sochi. Came back and said, what do we do? Well, the obvious thing was we're not going to let our sole all-year-round ice-free naval base, Sevastopol, in Crimea, go to NATO. And so let's ask the Crimeans who they want to rule them, the coup regime in Kiev or us. Well, long story short, they're annexed, okay? Now, that put the kibosh on all this sense of trust. After all, the coup was revealed on YouTube. Conversation between Assistant Secretary of State at the time, Victoria Nuland, and the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, Jeffrey Pyatt. When Jeffrey Pyatt says, but Miss Secretary, the EU, this coup is not going to go over well in the EU. She says, F. You know the next three letters, right? F the EU. Why do I mention that? Well, it's interesting, isn't it, for the attitude. But she admitted that 3 days later, giving complete credence to this intercept. In other words, it was authentic. It was 2.5 weeks. It was the 4th of February. The coup happened on the 22nd of February. Putin, I guess, felt like I did. Oh, well, that coup is blown. That's the intelligence term. You blow a coup, right? Then it doesn't happen. Well, it happened on Putin's last day in Sochi at the Olympics. So that started this downtrend. Did the U.S. really think they would take over Crimea? What did they do? Well, there was an initial offensive against these people in eastern Ukraine, the so-called Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk provinces, but they got pretty bloody, and everybody thought, we should have a ceasefire then. Long story short, there were two accords called the Minsk Accords, under which there would be a ceasefire, and under which these two provinces, these two oblasts, okay, Donetsk and Luhansk, would get a degree of autonomy under a new Ukrainian constitution. They were solidified. These agreements were signed, sealed, and delivered in 2015. Okay, guess what? The Ukrainians never changed their constitution. They never gave any autonomy to these oblasts, these provinces. Now, why was that? We know now. We know now because the German chancellor at the time, Angela Merkel, the French premier or president, actually, Hollande, okay, Poroshenko, president of Ukraine, and Zelensky himself, have all said, this was a trick. All we needed was 7 years to build up the Ukrainian army to NATO standards, give them NATO weapons, and then we'll take over these two provinces, which they were about to do when Russia intervened on February 22nd, I guess it was, of last year. So that's the background of all this. There was a growing trust here. But 6 months later, trust is not what we need. We need an enemy. And the best way to secure an enemy is, of course, to invade and try to set up. And this is, let me just finish with this, because this is real important, okay? Very few people know this. So Crimea was annexed a month after the invasion, or month after the coup. So the coup is the 22nd of February, 2014. After 1 month, there was an exit. And then a month later, Vladimir Putin got up and made a speech. It was on the anniversary of the annexation. And he said, you know, we had to annex Crimea. One factor, of course, was the plan to have Ukraine join NATO with Crimea part of Ukraine. But even more important, and I quote, even more important, were the offensive strike missile bases being put in Romania and Poland. Those emplacements are now there, okay? And they are ostensibly for anti-ballistic missiles. But guess what? They're in the wrong place for anti-ballistic missiles from Russia, okay? They're exactly the same diameter that can accommodate cruise missiles, Tomahawk. Putin calls them Tomahawk missiles, all right? And eventually, when the U.S. gets hypersonic missiles, which they will, the same diameter. So Romania, Poland, right hard up against the Russian frontier. Putin said in a major speech, December 21, 2021, to his high-ranking admirals and generals and the defense minister himself, he said, look, these emplacements, if they're Tomahawk cruise missiles, relatively slow flying, that gives me 7 to 10 minutes to decide, he didn't say it this way, but to decide whether to blow up the rest of the world. Now, if they're hypersonic missiles, says Putin, 5 minutes. I can't tolerate that. Now, he looked out. This is kind of cute. I mean, not cute, but telling. He looked out of those generals and admirals, and I could see in their faces what they were thinking. All right, well, how are you going to stop that? Putin says, so this time we needed a written agreement. And then he looked at these guys, and they're going, wasn't the ABM treaty written down? How about the intermediate nuclear forces? Yeah, Vladimir Vladimirovich, those things. Come on. That's the 21st of December, 2021. 9 days later, the Kremlin calls the White House. Putin has to talk to Biden right away. They had just talked 2 weeks previous. So the White House is flummoxed. You know, they say, why does he have to talk? Our negotiators are meeting in Geneva on the 9th and 10th of January. What's the deal? Please, Mr. Putin would like to talk to Biden, like right away. So to his credit, Biden accepts the call. What was the outcome of that call? The readout said, Mr. Joseph Biden said that Washington has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, period, end quote. The official readout, okay? So you have Putin facing into a senior military leaders on the 21st, and they singularly unimpressed by a new written agreement, right? Now we have a personal agreement from Biden himself to Putin on the telephone, no offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. The Russians were delighted. New Year's Eve was never so happy. Ushakov, the main advisor to Putin, was waxing eloquent. Oh, the Geneva negotiations on the 9th and 10th of January are going to be great. They're off to a great start. Guess what? When Biden woke up on New Year's Eve, Jacob Sullivan, maybe Blinken, said, Mr. President, you didn't really promise that, did you? Oh yeah, I thought maybe this would be a really good way to get some moving. Well, Mr. President, forget about it. And negotiators in Geneva, forget about it. And so 6 weeks later, on the 12th of February, so 10 days before the invasion, the last call between Biden and Putin, the readout said, in effect, they forgot about it. The issue of not emplacing strategic strike missiles in Ukraine was not even discussed. It was off the table. So this is part of the background. I mean, you know, they didn't want them in Crimea. I'm not sure I finished that sentence, but when Putin said a month after Crimea was annexed that membership in NATO was a major problem, but even more important, that was it. Even more important was to station intermediate, or what they call offensive strike missiles, in Crimea. Okay, Crimea, part of Ukraine. So, I mean, people don't know this because nobody reports it. Nobody listens to what Putin says, or even reads what he says. I print out his speeches and his Q&As. They're very fertile soil for analysis. That's what we used to do. Media analysis, an incredibly important part of political science, really, has been sort of tossed aside. Now, we know what Putin thinks. We know what he wants. And look, the Soviet Union didn't really collapse. They still want to take over at least Europe and maybe the rest of the world. It's what the British call rubbish.
Well, and it certainly cost people a lot of lives, unfortunately, with this situation in Ukraine, with the war in Ukraine, and really just even throughout the decades of just all the proxy wars that we've been fighting with Russia over the years to just kind of maintain this sort of evil nemesis. Now we're starting to see this, and really it was happening even throughout in the same time, the Cold War time, the proxy wars, really, even in the Southeast Asian area, throughout Asia, really. Did that have anything to do with China? And I'm curious if there's any country, I know Taiwan is the big topic of conversation when it comes to China. I can't imagine, though, Taiwan actually becoming the next Ukraine. I have a hard time believing that anyone is actually going to try to militarily destroy Taiwan. It's just too valuable, I suppose, when it comes to the technology that comes out of Taiwan. But there are other countries, poorer countries, you know, like Ukraine is a poorer country. So it's easier to go in there, I suppose, and let them be blown up than maybe a place like Taiwan. So I would imagine that there maybe would be a different country that the U.S. would pick a fight with China over? I know, like I said, I know that the rhetoric is over Taiwan, but curious your thoughts on that.
Well, you've hit on the tectonic shift in the war correlation of forces, Kim. You expressed doubt or uncertainty as to why the U.S. would take on both other major superpowers. It doesn't make any sense. Now, again, if you read what Putin says, to include these long 3-hour Q&A sessions, which are incredibly valuable, you know that he was asked about this back on the 27th of August at Valdai, the discussion club. He said, Mr. President, how do you account for the United States taking on China at the same time as they're taking us on in Ukraine and sending all kinds of weaponry to Ukraine? How do you analyze that? And I memorized what Putin said. He says, you know, it doesn't really hold much logic, does it? I think they're just crazy. Sumashechi. Out of mind, walking shitsi. Sumashechi, they're just out of their minds, okay? And then he adds, he says, the only way to account for this is overweening arrogance and a feeling of impunity. Now, I happen to agree that that's how to explain this. But it doesn't matter what McGovern agrees or thinks. It's what Putin thinks and what his best friend Xi thinks. And, you know, if they think that U.S. policymakers are crazy, that's a problem. That's really dangerous, because what can they expect? Their military people come to them and say, look, we can't depend on anything sensible on the part of the U.S. people. We have to be prepared for the worst because they are crazy. And when we start to win in a definitive way in Ukraine, they are crazy enough to up the ante, to escalate still further. And we don't know where this is going to end. So let's remind them that we too have nuclear weapons. Let's remind them that we can even put nuclear weapons in our ally countries, like Belarus. I mean, after all, they have nuclear weapons in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Germany, in Turkey, and in Italy, 5 NATO countries. Why can't we just put them in Belarus to remind them, look, we can do this too, and also to have a bargaining chip. Maybe it would be really nice to get those nuclear weapons out of those NATO countries. So this is accounting for a lot of what Putin is doing now. But the real crux here, Kim, in my view, is what's going to happen in the next month or two. It looks like the Russians have just about succeeded in taking that Bakhmut place there. That's the keystone right there in Ukraine. So as I see it now, the crucible is reached. They can, with their 200,000 plus additional troops from the mobilization, move forward all the way to the Dnieper River, which is the natural divide between Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine, and then say, all right, now, do you want Ukraine to exist as a viable country? For that, they need Odessa. They need access to the Black Sea. We haven't taken Odessa yet, but we can. Now, are you prepared to deal now, or do we go farther? Do we go all the way to the Romanian border? What do you want? Okay. That's going to be the situation that Biden, to the degree he's compass mentis, and his sturdy group of nincompoop advisors face. What are they going to do? Now, for Putin, once again, this is an existential threat of the same kind we faced in Cuba in 1962. Medium-range ballistic missiles on our periphery, okay? Existential threat. For Biden, even Obama said, Ukraine is not an existential threat to us. We ought to be real careful about what commitments we make. For Obama, okay? Now, is it an existential threat for Biden politically? My God, I suppose you could read it that way. Not strategically. but politically is really important this next year and a half, isn't it? Okay. So what are they going to do? I don't know, but Putin himself has said more than once that U.S. foreign policy and military policy is often fashioned first and foremost on the basis of domestic political exigencies.
Which is very scary, unfortunately, because this is not heading us anywhere good. There's nothing good about our foreign policy at this point. I can't see any outcome with our current foreign policy that's going to be beneficial to the American people or anyone in the world, quite frankly.
You know, there's one thing, Kim, sorry to interrupt you, but, you know, Lukashenko, the head of Belarus, called for an immediate ceasefire, okay? So did Xi Jinping in the presence of Putin. Now, it doesn't take a real smart analyst to understand that, therefore, Putin wants a ceasefire too. Why? Lukashenko, I think, revealed why. He said there have been 100,000 killed on each side in Ukraine. Now, most people think that, no, it's disproportionate. But this is Lukashenko, and he should know, right? He lives right nearby in the same neighborhood. So I think that Putin doesn't want to lose any more people. That he's prepared to lose them because there's an existential threat, but he's saying, look, this is the time to deal, okay? Now, not as the new election approaches months from now. Now, are you prepared to deal? We have Lukashenko. We have menacing things with nuclear weapons in Belarus. We have Xi Jinping together with us as never before. Will you deal now, or will you still dream that you can keep China away from Russia and keep Belarus pacified? Okay, so I'm thinking, hey, here's your last chance before we go to the Dnieper. Now, all indicating logic would suggest that we take that chance, sit down and see what kind of deal we could cut, okay? But there's no logic in the way the neocons approach this. I think they would reach, well, they already rejected. They made fun of it. They even made fun of the last couple of things. Yeah, they made fun. They said it was an April Fool. April Fool when Russia announced its major foreign policy rationale, the first one since 2016, the new one that embodies everything they're doing right now. They say, well, this is an April Fool joke, okay? So if they were reduced to that kind of adolescent Western attitude, and Putin and the rest of them are quite used to that, then I think this is the last chance before we reach the Dnieper. And when I point out, when I point to Odessa, well, I'll just mention one other thing. You know, it's a hopeful thing when you look at what Putin orchestrates in terms of what questions are asked him. Now, I don't think he orchestrates everyone, but I think this one he did, again, at Valdai on October 27th. One of these reporters says, Mr. President, I'm thinking of traveling to Odessa in several months. Do you think I should apply for a Ukrainian visa or Russian visa? Pretty clever, huh? So Putin says, ah, Odessa, a beautiful city. No more beautiful city than Odessa. But you know, Odessa has become, what do you call it? An item of conflict, okay? Oh yeah, he borrowed from the Trojan War. A yabloko razdora. Yabloko is apple, okay? You know about the apple that started the Trojan War, okay? A yabloko razdora. Razdora is conflict. Or Odessa could be a way to resolve our differences in a rational way. Whoa! What's he saying? Well, I'm saying he says all this very deliberately, having planted the question. And he's saying, look, you need, if you're going to have a viable Ukraine that is anything other than just a farmland for the rest of Europe, you need to have access to the Black Sea. We can take Odessa in 2 weeks. We'll stop there. If you deal, you can have a viable Ukrainian state with Odessa, but we're going to have to be up So the Dnieper all accept Odessa, and we're going to have to be as far forward to protect ourselves from the range of weapons that you put in the west of Ukraine. Both Lavrov and Putin have said, now it comes to geography. If you put in missile weaponry or other weaponry that reaches 100 miles, that means geography will dictate that we go 100 more miles to the west. It's very simple. So, in other words, this is not McGovern just making up Odessa. This is Putin mentioning Odessa, and it could be a яблоко раздора, an object, an apple of discord, or it could be a way to arrange these things. Now, did anyone mention that in the press? No. Did anybody pick up on that by these benighted people like Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken? Not that I know of. I doubt that any analyst in the CIA, getting back to our original discussion, would have the guts to report, look, looks like Putin is offering a little suggestion here, guys. You might want to think about it, because the prevailing sentiment is so anti-Russian, is so so controlled, and so it would be a really courageous thing to do, to say, look, you know, there's maybe a way out of this, and maybe that person would not get promoted for the next 2 decades. It's, you know, it comes down to that, and also the people that I mentioned, the kind that are run by these malleable managers now. It's really bad, and I doubt that that Sullivan or Blinken, and certainly not Victoria Nuland in the State Department, is going to get any of these little straws in the wind that people like Putin put out. This one was a big one, Odessa. I don't think they even were told about it, and I don't think, like me, they read those speeches and the Q&A.
Well, thank you, George, for all of your Ray, for all of your insight. Thank you so much for all of your insight, and thank you for being here to talk to us about this. It is, you know, stressful times thinking that our intelligence agencies aren't really being utilized the way that they should be, that our foreign policy is just blast away, it seems, and don't look back. I don't know where this takes us, but hopefully the craziness calms down. I mean, as you mentioned, if they're just crazy and they're just operating off of what seems to be insanity, which is what it does look like in a lot of ways, all the posturing against these big nations like Russia and China and just continuing to march forward, not caring. I mean, it's like our foreign policy advisors or whoever it is that's actually in control. If it's not Biden, it sounds like it isn't. You know, it's like Russia says, if you do this, we'll use nukes. And our team says, okay, well then let's do that. That sounds like a good idea. It does seem like operating with insanity. And I know living in LA, the one thing we're taught, you know, when you're walking around the streets is kind of avoid the crazy people, because if somebody's crazy, you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know. You have no idea what they're going to do because they're crazy. And so you don't know if they're going to bite your face thinking, you know, because they're on bath salts or something. And that's what we're kind of dealing with, it seems like, with our foreign policy. So, Ray, really appreciate you breaking it down a bit for us. And
Kim,
appreciate
if I could
you
just
always
add
being,
a,
yeah.
If I could just add a thought. You know, when you asked before, do these folks really believe that Russia wants to take over Europe or the rest of the world still? I mean, it did at one point, right? I just don't know. They are very poorly educated. The people who were educated by the people who educated me knew about Russia, knew about Russian history, knew about Russia's experience in World War II, knew a lot about Russia, okay, how they look at things. What I'm saying here is that what does Tony Blinken know about Russia or Jacob Sullivan? Zippo. So who do they listen to? They listen to Michael McFaul, head of Stanford policy on, you know, he's a professor at Stanford, and he was ambassador to Russia under Obama, and before that he was director of Russian analysis at the National Security Council. He knows all about Russia. So what does he say? 3 days ago, after Xi Jinping and Putin demonstrated in an unmistakable way that there's a new alliance here that the West has to take into account. What does Michael McFaul say in a tweet? He says, aha, now Putin has humiliated Xi Jinping. Because even though they said in their joint statement that no country should put nuclear weapons in other countries, now Putin has said he's going to do precisely that in Belarus. This is not going to go down well in Beijing, says Michael McFaul. Now, that joint statement was boilerplate. Every time they say this kind of thing, they say, no, you don't put weapons in, nuclear weapons in other countries, like the U.S. has done with five countries in NATO, okay? So it's boilerplate. Now, to think that this guru of Russian studies at Stanford and the guy who's talking into the ear of Blinken and Sullivan is telling them, don't worry about it. You know, Xi Jinping is going to be very offended because Putin just humiliated him, okay? One day after that, apparently, the Chinese defense minister didn't get the memo because they announced a step up, a real increase in joint exercises, in joint training, in joint maneuvers of all kinds in the military sphere. So, you know, here's the military reflection of this closeness, and McFaul is trying to have everyone believe that, no, Russia and China, they're still at loggerheads. He told Biden to say that at the first summit in June 16th, 2001. Biden said after the summit, this is inappropriate for me to tell you what I told Mr. Putin, but he's got this long border with China, several thousand miles. He knows that China aspires to be the most powerful country, not just economically, but in the whole world, and especially in Asia. He's being squeezed by China. Biden's word. Now, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when Putin turned to his colleagues watching the boob tube, watching Biden say this before he got on the plane. He said, huh? Oh my God, you know? So these guys don't get it. More recently, Biden, apropos of nothing, said, you know, I'm convinced that Xi Jinping doesn't trust Putin. I wouldn't trust him because he's a killer. I mean, so this is Neverland, which would be funny, but it ain't funny because these people cannot take the people running stuff in our country seriously. And so they have to be prepared for the worst. The worst is going to come. The denouement is going to come in Ukraine. It's not going to come in Asia. You're quite right, Kim. The U.S. would be crazier than crazy to challenge the Chinese military in Asia. I mean, something like supply lines apply here, right? So I just want to say that this insight came to me when McFaul said, Putin has humiliated Xi Jinping and China. This is not going to go well down China. Well, you know, this is so missing the point on the tectonic shift that it explains to me why Blinken, Sullivan, Nuland can say, well, Ambassador McFaul says this, and he's teaching a new course on this. Just started today, mind you. He announced it on Twitter about this great power relationship. He must know, and he is just as responsible as anyone else for the fact that the growing trust that I talked about in 2013 dissipated into the abominable situation that exists now in relations between Russia and the United States. And I've been watching these relations for six decades now. I'm ashamed to admit I've never seen it worse or more dangerous.
That's not comforting. That's not comforting, Ray. But it's the truth. It is the truth. And unfortunately, you know, I say, well, they're not crazy enough to go and turn Taiwan into Ukraine, but they might be crazy enough. I mean, we don't know how crazy They are. We're seeing that they are, every move they make is crazier and crazier. So I guess we shouldn't put anything past them. And you're right. That's what other foreign leaders are doing when they're making these sort of agreements, these pacts. They're joining together because, and they're getting ready. You know, China, you see them getting ready because they don't know how crazy we are. We don't know how crazy we are. So,
you know, Kim, one last thought here. There's a racial tint to all this. You know, America's original sin, in my view, is racism. Right now, the word, the authoritative narrative is that we have isolated Russia, right? What have we done? Look at NATO. What's characteristic of NATO, more characteristic than any other group of such kind? They're all white. What has happened now, and this is more dangerous than one can imagine, is that we have what the Russians and Chinese now call the collective West, the lily white West against the rest of the world. 80% people of color, China, 1.4 billion, India, 1.5 billion, Indonesia, South Africa, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, for God's sake, okay? Russia. All these people, well, Russians are have been blackened to the degree that most people of color as well. But the idea is that nothing could be farther than the truth that Russia has been isolated. Russia's on the side of all these other people. And when push comes to shove, that's a very, very, very difficult situation because with all these people up in arms against what's happened, with all these people, and I saw it at the UN when I gave the briefing there on the 21st of February. The Brazilians, as I say, were wishy-washy. Now they voted against, they voted for the Russian resolution, that is with China and Russia, that there should be an independent investigation of blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. So you have the most of the world is against the lily white West. And maybe I could finish with a little thing from Rudyard Kipling, which I think illustrates this in a poetic way. You ready? It is not wise for the Christian white to hustle the Asian brown. For the Christian smiles, but the Asian riles, and he weareth the Christian down. At the end of the fight lies a tombstone white with the name of the late deceased, and the epitaph drear, a fool lies here who tried to hustle the East. Foolish in the extreme.
Yeah, that is the truth. That is the truth, Ray. Thank you so much for being here. Wonderful conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.